All right, good evening.
Evening.
Good to see y'all back here this evening. I'm excited to dive into the Word. Another opportunity to spend time here together. If you're a guest this evening, welcome in. We're honored to have you at Ypsilanti Church of Christ. If you are a guest, you're looking for a church home, hey, we'd love to be that for you. To our regulars, members, welcome back. We're on the third chapter of Ruth, meaning we're, already over midway through already. And to many of us, this should all be quite familiar, but for those of us who need or would like a recap of what we've covered thus far in the past few weeks in the book of Ruth, we have you covered. A lot happened in the first two chapters, right? With chapter one, it was primarily explaining how Naomi got to the point where she was left with, just a daughter-in-law to her name. Her husband, Elimelech, whose name, he transplanted his family from Bethlehem all the way to the pagan land of Moab in search of greener pastures in the midst of a famine. Now, it doesn't sound too much like he trusts in God, does it? He transplanted his whole family into the land of the enemies of God. And it was there that his two sons made wives from among Moabite women. And it was also there that one after another, the men in the family, the husband and both sons, met their end. They passed away. Naomi, for her part, hearing that God had been and was continuing to provide for her loved ones over in Bethlehem, her homeland, she attempted to persuade her daughters-in-law, these two remaining women, to remain in Moab. And only one, Orpah, reluctantly agreed. Ruth, the other daughter, on the other hand, she clung to her, and she agreed to take her mother-in-law's customs, her culture, her religion as her own, all of this, and go back with her to Bethlehem. So, Naomi reluctantly agrees that's what they do. Last week, we talked about chapter 2. We talked about what happened once the women had both touched down in Bethlehem. And because Naomi, she's originally disheartened. She's telling folks they shouldn't use her name. Instead, they should call her Mara, which means bitter, because the Lord has dealt with her bitterly. Ruth, on the other hand, she knows that they can't sit around moping forever. God has been good to this land, and she plans to kind of reap what God has sowed. So she goes out into the fields to collect food. And by the hand of God, she winds up in the field of a man named Boaz, a near kinsman or a close relation of the deceased Elimelech. Boaz, as we learn, is a good man he's earned the respect of his workers. That's hard to come across. And when he sees Ruth come into the field, he commands his workers to take care of her, give her gallons worth of grain. He even invites Ruth into his home and allows her to dip her bread in the same pot as him, which might not sound like such a big deal, but in that culture, it really was, because it signified trust. It signified intimacy between two parties. And for Boaz, as part of this, kind of is to signify that he has started to show even a little bit of interest in Ruth. Ruth, she returns home to tell her mother-in-law of everything that has transpired. Naomi tells her, stay close by Boaz and stay in his field. And that's really where we arrive at our passage for this morning. And as you know, we've been trying to really kind of place things together one chapter at a time. But as I was putting the content for this evening together, I realized that there was so much to overview. Ruth chapter 3 is so chock full of information that it might be smarter to divvy chapter 3 into two halves. So we're only going to look at the first half of Ruth chapter 3 today. Turn your Bibles over to Ruth chapter 3 if you don't mind. But these nine verses, although they're short, there's a lot going on, and there's a lot we're going to get to explain and talk about, and I'm really excited to do so. So again, that's Ruth chapter 3, where we're going to pick up in verse 1. All right, it says, "Then Naomi, her mother-in-law, said to her, 'My daughter, shall I not seek security for you, that it may be well with you? Now Boaz, whose young women you were with, is he not our relative? In fact, he's winnowing barley tonight at the threshing floor. Therefore, wash yourself and anoint yourself, put on your best garment, and go down to the threshing floor. But do not make yourself known to the man until he has finished eating and drinking. Then it shall be when he lies down that you shall notice the place where he lies. You shall go in, uncover his feet, and lie down, and he will tell you what you should do. And she said to her, all that you say to me, I will do. All right, so that was our key passage, and we've got a lot to go over in just these first five verses. There's a lot going on. So the first thing I want to make note of, that there's been a bit of a time jump from the end of Ruth chapter 2 to the beginning of Ruth chapter 3. Remember, Ruth she's been gleaning all the way through to the end of the harvest, so time has passed. They kind of have a pretty good idea of who Boaz is by this point, but let's reread verse 1. Naomi, her mother-in-law, said to her, my daughter, shall I not seek security for you, that it may be well with you? That's profound there, because the Hebrew word for security, that's the same word for rest that was used in Ruth chapter 1, verse 9, where Naomi, she hoped that her daughters-in-law would find rest, would find security in the home of a new husband. She's reusing that phrase. And the Hebrew word menawah speaks what a home should be. It's a place of rest. It's a place of security. And I want you to hang on to this, what Naomi is seeking after for Ruth, because we're going to return back to that idea kind of right before we close. The second thing we need to look over is verse 2. Who is Boaz to Naomi and Ruth? She says so right here. Is he not our relative? Is he not our relative? There's a lot of implications behind just that small statement. Because remember, back in chapter 1, Naomi, she had to tell Ruth, she had to tell Orpah, like, hey, I have no children left for you to marry. My sons are dead. They're gone. I have nothing I can offer you. And she said so because in that culture, it would have been the custom of the brother to marry his deceased brother's wife so she would have someone to take care of her, so she would not have to live as a widow, which was a difficult way of life, which was a dangerous, awful way of life. It's very difficult. So we see the gears turning in Naomi's mind here, and then flash forward into chapter 3. We see the gears turning. Now, she has no immediate sons that Ruth could marry, but this Boaz fellow, he's related to Elimelech. Okay, Naomi's suggestion for Ruth to pursue Boaz, then, it's rooted in a custom in ancient Israel. It's the Hebrew word is goel. And Goel means, and we've already talked about this, kinsman redeemer. And the kinsman redeemer in the Israelite tradition served a couple different purposes. In the book of Leviticus, it says the kinsman redeemer, it was someone who was responsible for buying a fellow Israelite out of slavery or purchasing back family land that had been forfeit. The book of Numbers adds in, it says the kinsman redeemer is responsible for being an avenger of blood, is the term it uses, which in essence means if a family member is murdered, the kinsman redeemer makes sure that the killer answers to their crime. And finally, the book of Deuteronomy, it makes it clear that the kinsman redeemer is someone who's responsible for carrying on the family name by marrying the childless widow. It's starting to make sense, right? Naomi's letting Ruth know that she could appeal to Boaz to guard Elimelech's family name, to take her hand in marriage. And all this may seem very forward to us, and it is, but it was regarded as very proper in that day. Speaking of things that might sound a little strange to us in 21st century America, Naomi tells Ruth exactly how she is to win Boaz's favor. She's very detailed. She says, first, wash and anoint yourself. That makes sense. Wear your best garment. That makes sense. But then she says, go to the place where he lies and uncover his feet. Okay. Right? Okay, sure. Some of us might think this is a bit of a provocative gesture. It certainly sounds interesting. But that's not how the gesture was understood in the day. On the contrary, in the culture of that day, this was actually something that was understood as an act of total submission. In that day, it was understood that the role of the servant, someone who served, they would lay at their master's feet to be at the beck and call, to be ready for the command of their master. So when Ruth is told to lie down at Boaz's feet, Naomi, she's telling her, I need you to be totally humble, to completely humble yourself in this very submissive way with the heart of a servant. And remember, he's the kinsman redeemer. She doesn't have to do it this way. She could just march up to Boaz and tell him, you are the kinsman redeemer. This is your role. This is what I'm demanding of you. She can tell him what to do. But no, instead, Naomi, she has Ruth act humbly. She has her go out on a limb. And don't get me wrong, this is an interesting plan. There's a non-zero chance that all of this could backfire horribly. Boaz is not in the loop. But Naomi says, he'll tell you what you should do. So they're putting a large amount of faith in this man, in his capability to make the right choice, in his capability to make the good choice in this situation. And Ruth, she buys in. She says, all right, all that you say to me, I will do. And let's continue onward in the text, because all of this planning, it culminates into a pretty unique interaction starting in verse 6. It says, so she went down to the threshing floor and did according to all that her mother-in-law instructed her. And after Boaz had eaten and drunk and his heart was cheerful, he went to lie down at the end of the heap of grain. She came softly, uncovered his feet, and lay down. All right, so Boaz, he spent the whole day at the threshing floor. He's likely taking his time to crush the stalks, to separate the grain from the chaff. And this is tiring work, but after he's eaten, drank, he's in a pretty good mood. He probably had a very good yield that day. But the text says he went to lie down at the end of the heap of grain. Okay, again, this is another thing that sounds odd to us here and now, but in the context of the time, starts to make a little bit more sense. Well, why wouldn't he go home? Well, remember, we're in the time of the judges when there's this political, social instability in Israel, and even though Boaz is someone who's doing very well for himself, right? Even though God had provided for the people of Bethlehem, no, it didn't mean that they were completely safe. It wasn't unusual still for gangs of thieves to come and steal all the hard-earned grain that a farmer had grown. So Boaz, he's sleeping on the threshing floor. He's sleeping here where he had separated the grain from the chaff to guard against attacks. That's very likely why he was there. So put yourself in the mind of Boaz. He's the rich man that owns the fields, but right now he's on guard duty. And we can continue in verse 8. Now it happened at midnight that the man was startled and turned himself, and there a woman was lying at his feet. He said, who are you? So she answered, I'm Ruth, your maidservant. Take your maidservant under your wing, for you are a close relative. Okay. So, we said earlier that Naomi's plan placed a ton of trust in the goodness of Boaz. When we said that, we're not exaggerating, right? It also placed a bit of hope in the fact that he would stay his hand when he thought that he was under attack. Because, again, Boaz is on guard duty, knowing that the most likely visitors to the threshing floor at midnight would most likely be these gangs of roving thieves, it's not too much of a stretch for us to infer that Boaz was probably armed. So from this perspective, in the middle of the night, an unknown assailant sneaks onto the threshing floor, uncovers his feet, and lays down. And let me be honest, I know some of us view this moment as pure and romantic, but the initial seconds of this encounter must have been horrifying for Boaz. Truly. But then his fear turns to a little bit of a confusion when he hears the voice of his would-be attacker and hears that it's a woman. And she identifies herself and makes this simple, humble request. She says, take your maidservant under your wing, for you are a close relative. Close relative, kinsman, redeemer. That's the same meaning here. And the phrase she uses also could be translated as, spread the corner of your garment over me. Which was just a culturally relevant way to say, I am a widow, please take me as your wife. Boaz, I'm sure, needed a moment to catch his breath. But the majority of the remainder of the chapter, it's comprised of their discussion. And it's a good one for the sake of being able to give it the attention that it deserves. We'll be talking about it next week. For now, though, we kind of wrap up our reading a little bit on a little bit of a cliffhanger, but before we close, I want to take a moment to revisit a portion of the text that is particularly relevant for our application as Christians. For us, that means going all the way back to verse 1, all the way back to that idea of Naomi seeking rest or Manoah for her daughter-in-law, Ruth. Now, it turns out that that sort of rest can only be found in the kinsman redeemer. In many ways, we as human beings are just like Ruth. We're constantly seeking rest in one way or another, right? Like if you went to college, you probably met that guy or girl that switched majors 4 or 5 or 6 or 7 times. Like they're constantly trying to keep an eye out for the thing that stuck. And like it or not, we've all got a little bit of that in us. I think we're always moving from one thing to the next, trying to find a place, trying to find a situation or a circumstance in which we feel content. Whether it be from one job to the next, one degree to the next, one hobby to the next. We're always, always moving. We're always trying to find contentment somewhere new. That's human nature. But like Ruth, that rest, that contentment can only be found in a Redeemer. For us, that's Jesus Christ. And similarly to the kinsman Redeemer, Christ bought us out when we had no hope left, but he bought us with blood. He repaid our debts with the life that was given on the cross. If you're here, you believe this to be true, but you've not yet been baptized in the name of the Father, Son, Holy Spirit for the remission of your sins, now is the time. As we talked about already this morning, the water's ready. The only thing that's missing is you. Now, alternatively, if you're seeking prayer or congregational support for any reason whatsoever, we believe strongly in the power of prayer here at Ypsilanti Church of Christ. We would love to pray with and for you. So if you're here this evening, you would like either of these things, to please do come to this front row of pews as we stand and sing.
The path of sin to long I've trod. Lord, I'm coming home, coming home, coming home. Never more to know. Oh, Lord, I'm coming home. I will taste that precious years. Now I'm coming home. I now prepare with eternity. Lord, I'm coming home, coming home, coming home, never more to Lord, I'm coming home. My soul is sick, my heart is sore. Now I'm coming home, My strength renew, my hope restore. Lord, I'm coming home, coming home. Coming home, never more to run. Oh, my God, thine arms Lord, I'm coming home.